Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What can you do when your friends get sick of you prying into their problems?
Do what everyone else is doing, of course. Start a podcast.
Introducing If I Speak, a brand new podcast from me, Ash Sarkar.
And me, Moya Lothian-McLean, where we pitch each other our big theories about the universe, share the intrusive thoughts keeping us up at night, and best of all, tackle your personal dilemmas.
We'll be asking questions like, does tabloid gossip turn us all into conspiracy theorists?
Should you financially support a parent?
Is Moya turning into a bit of a femcel?
Yes. What's Ash's most toxic trait?
Interrupting. From dating disorders to family feuds, career dilemmas to online etiquette.
The political gets personal on If I Speak.
Find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's gossip elevated.
Hello and welcome to this episode of Intelligent Squared. I'm lead producer, Catherine Hughes. In today's episode, recorded on the 17th of April, 2023, we explore brainwashing, the process of pressuring someone into adopting radically different beliefs by using systematic and often forcible means. Daniel Pick, a psychoanalyst, historian, and professor emeritus of history at Birkbeck College, University of London, joined Subhadra Das, broadcaster, academic, and writer with a keen interest in the history of eugenics, to delve into the murky history and psychology of brainwashing and to discuss Pick's latest book, Brainwashed, A New History of Thought Control. To listen ad-free and to support our mission to foster honest debate and compelling conversations, head to intelligentsquared.com/membership.
Welcome to Intelligent Squared, Daniel.
Thank you very much.
I want to dive in almost immediately into what sounds like a conspiracy theory about Edward Hunter, from whom we get the term brainwashing. And that was written about by your colleague, Marcia Holmes, on your Hidden Persuaders blog. Was this his own idea or was he put up to it by the CIA?
I wouldn't call it a conspiracy theory about Hunter, but it's true by way of context, which, as you're suggesting, really, that he comes out of the world of wartime intelligence. He's involved in the Office of Strategic Services. Hunter also has links with the CIA post-war. So his ideas are congruent with those of many others in the intelligence world. Their suspicions about what's going on in Soviet Russia, also in communist China in that period. And it's certainly also the case that the idea of brainwashing and this crisis around brainwashing is an opportunity for those who want to push the case for research and development and greater funding for the kinds of experiments that go on in the 1950s, funded by intelligence organizations in the West, notably the CIA, is also part of a bigger conversation that's going on both sides of the Atlantic. There's a report in the Guardian newspaper in the UK in 1950 as well about Chinese brainwashing. So the term resonates. It's coined in this period, it's popularized, it's used to describe techniques of mind control that it's argued are being developed in new ways in the communist world, above all in China, this idea of thought reform or re-education.
Well, that's an interesting point that you make, because I'm a historian of eugenics, and so I often have to confront the notion that eugenics is somehow an idea as old as time, which some people would argue that it is, I would argue that it isn't. But to what degree, then, is brainwashing a new idea? It seems a very 20th century, 21st century concern, but is it much older? How do we conceive of it?
In thinking about researching the book and this wider project on the Cold War human sciences and brainwashing, I was very interested in that question, how much is there something really new going on in this post-war period that brainwashing describes? So we have a new term, but we also have a claim in that post-war period that there are new phenomena that have to be addressed, which is to do with the uses of technology, the use of drugs, the use of new kinds of psychological techniques to break people and remake people, refashion the mind. And so that one of the popular ideas of that period, or dreads, was that ideology and science could kind of be brought together in a way to completely orchestrate the mind of a prisoner. Now, whether that's new or old, I think that's a really important question. I think the idea of mind control, of the possession of the mind, ideas about fascination and manipulation are much older. I mean, you can run that story back to ancient history, you know, the idea of the takeover of the mind. But I think there is, as you suggested, Subhadra, there's something new going on here, both in the language of brainwashing and in the kind of context for all of this, of the Cold War, which is seen often as a war for morale, a sort of psychological warfare coming into it. So brainwashing both describes that and it sort of sets up a debate that feels new about the question of mind manipulation, both under communism and under capitalism.
Yes, and there's a double-sidedness to the whole question that I think is absolutely fascinating. The new kind of medical aspect about it, and in the way in the West, how the idea was very much framed as something that happens, it's something the bad guys do. This is something that kind of happens elsewhere. And there were aspects of it that were carried out by Nazi geneticists and experimentation who were tried at Nuremberg. There's definitely a propaganda kind of aspect as to how the idea is spoken about in the West as to who carries out the brainwashing. Is that a fair assessment?
I think that's right, because it becomes part of a critique of psychology, psychiatry, even psychoanalysis later on, and the potential to convert people. And you mentioned medicine and Nuremberg, but clearly this period is one in which there's profound discussion about the way in which the doctors can be co-opted into all sorts of hideous and nefarious political and social projects. So I think that is a context in the Nuremberg medical trials and the question of what can be done to the body, but also to the mind. And you mentioned earlier, you know, the history of eugenics and your interest in that. So I think one could look back to the late 19th century and the idea both of claims about the power of science to engineer the population, to, as it were, reorganize populations with negative eugenics, stopping the so-called unfit people to have babies and encouraging the so-called fit to have large families. But that whole kind of period of the late Victorian era where the as it were, the engineering of populations biologically is such a fraught and important topic. And in this period, the idea of the engineering of the mind through the human sciences becomes a hot topic of debate in popular culture and society.
Absolutely. I wonder whether we can think about the popularity of the eugenics movement at the turn of the 20th century, kind of in these terms, because there is an aspect of populism that takes over at that time. And this idea that science is going to be the thing that saves everyone. And I think there is those concerns to do with the power of science, the power of scientists and the power of science and the state is really inherent when we come to thinking about brainwashing. I think it's kind of important before we get too far into the discussion, but what would count as brainwashing? You've talked about some of the mechanisms involved, but in terms of a definition, what does it look like to someone, say, in the middle of the 20th century?
Well, I think for someone like Hunter and some of these other writers of that post-war period who are writing about this, I mean, the primary concern is so-called totalitarian societies. I mean, that's another vexed term, totalitarianism, that's part of political philosophy in that period. But the idea of a state where the individual is totally subordinate to the state, the totality. I mean, the total state was an idea that had also been earlier on praised. I mean, there were philosophers who thought this was a good thing, the idea of a total harmony between the citizen and the state. So into war, it has other connotations, but it comes to be a term really to describe something very, very sinister. And we're familiar with it through George Orwell, through Hannah Arendt and other writers who kind of take up these ideas of the total state. So I think initially brainwashing is seen as something that we have to worry about in these so-called totalitarian societies. And the particular focus is Mao's China, as you mentioned. People's Republic of China has just been established, and that's the focus of concern initially is that. But also Stalinism, Soviet Union, and back shadowed by the history of fascism Nazism. So the idea of a society where the population, not just literal prisoners, but the population are held in thrall to a tyrannical dictatorial figure or party, and thinking has to be subordinated to the interests of that collective endeavor. And so brainwashing initially is used to describe what can be done to the human subject in conditions of total control, to sort of break someone down, to get rid of, purge them of what's seen as the sort of bad thoughts or the pernicious thoughts or the mistaken thoughts, and then to replace them with a set of beliefs that are coherent with the interests of the dictator or the party or both.
And that's the real concern from the point of view of the West, isn't it? Which is that if a washing of the brain can take place, so this idea that, you know, we're going back to John Locke, the blank slate, that a blank slate of a human mind exists. So it's not so much the washing aspect that is a problem, it's the what's being programmed, which is another interesting metaphor, what's being put in its place.
Yes, and I think really from the beginning of the Cold War on, there's an idea that this is something the other side does. So of course, in the Soviet Union, there are ideas about brainwashing through advertising under capitalism. But this Western idea is about, as you say, the getting rid of the impure thoughts and the replacement with a set of beliefs that are the desired thoughts. And there are techniques that we know that, you know, with prisoners to isolate, to disturb, to traumatize, that are used in different groups and community societies. So one set of ideas is to do with breakdown, of what you can do to break someone, to create dread and despair and despondency. So there's quite a sort of literature in that period to try to understand how these mechanisms work, what you can do to a captive subject, both to destroy or damage and sort of get past people's ordinary defenses and ways of coping, to, as it were, cause people to have often a kind of regression through this trauma to a sort of infantile state of total helplessness. And then to introduce sets of beliefs or often figures who are seen as the person they can turn to, like a good cop, bad cop, to provide then a kind of person to whom you can turn. And that figure can often in this literature is understood to be the person who, as it were, grooms you towards the new sets of beliefs once the initial breakdown has been produced.
That's a lot of effort, really, isn't it? The thing that you're describing, and what was the education for me from your book, was I think I had an idea that brainwashing was kind of like a computer program. You wipe the disk, you put in a new program, you're done. But this is actually a much more personalized approach, really. You can't necessarily guarantee the outcome of how a person is going to be influenced and what they're going to end up thinking.
In my sort of attempt to understand this in the book, it's to, in a way, insist on each story being different, that people are not just sort of cogs in a machine. You know, whatever the fantasies are of producing some sort of robotic conformist state of mind, actually each story of imprisonment, of so-called re-education, is going to be different because we experience the world differently. We each have our own, we bring our own psyche to bear. Nonetheless, there is also something being explored in this period that's important about techniques that are widely used to deal with and tame and produce kinds of conformity in prisoner groups. And that period sees a lot of research on, you know, as well as also experimentation in the use of drugs, sedative drugs, but also hallucinogenic drugs, the use of sleep deprivation. One of the really disturbing aspects of this story, which is now well documented by historians, are the CIA-funded research projects that have code names like MK Ultra, which now historians have managed through freedom of information decades ago to get access to this material, and people can read it online, MK Ultra and some of the Kubark manual. But these attempts to sort of, in a way, theorize and document and synthesize the research on sensory deprivation, sensory overload as well, stress positions, all these sort of techniques that are developed in that period and that then came to wider consciousness, I think, later on in the period of the so-called war on terror and that euphemism enhanced interrogation that people may well be familiar with. But that's, again, sort of, there's an earlier set of projects and experiments from the 1950s onwards that really provided a foundation for those later ideas and practices.
Mm-hmm. We make a lot of stuff here at Intelligence Squared. So many great chats to enrich the mind, like the one you're listening to now. But like any business, it's really essential to be in good shape and keep things efficient, so you can see the big picture all in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems, and it's super easy to get started because NetSuite exists in the cloud, so no hardware needed, cutting your IT costs too. And you'll also improve efficiency by bringing all your major processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. The cost of living crisis might not be making anything any cheaper, but there's real value in feeling on top of things, which is something I experience firsthand as an event producer every day. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared. Intelligence Squared is a tight-knit team doing big things, and it means we're always looking for tools that can help streamline managing tasks. That's why I want to talk to you for a minute about NetSuite. NetSuite provides cloud-based software to get things moving. Maybe your business has been humming, but you can feel things are falling behind a little bit. Or perhaps your team is getting snowed with manual tasks and closing those books is taking forever. If this sounds like you, you should know these three numbers: 37,000, 25, 1. 37,000, that's the number of businesses which have upgraded to NetSuite by Oracle. 25, NetSuite turns 25 this year. That's 25 years of helping businesses do more with less, allowing them to close their books in days, not weeks, and drive down costs. And one, because your business is one of a kind, so you get a customized solution for all of your KPIs in one efficient system with one source of truth. It means you can manage risk, get reliable forecasts, and improve margins. It's everything you need to grow all in one place. NetSuite is now making an unprecedented offer to make more of that kind of thing possible. Right now, you can download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist designed to give you consistently excellent performance absolutely free at netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared to get your own KPI checklist. netsuite.com/squared. Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theater, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece, Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents. With the code SQUARED, simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code SQUARED to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV.
I want to pick up on a word that you used earlier, which is this idea of taming subjects. And I'm interested in that from a particular point of view to do with notions of being civilized and ways of being civilized in society. One of the things that you do very well in the book is that you speak very fluently and very eloquently about ideas to do with racism and sexism in our society. And this is speaking as a non-white reader, and the market for audiences definitely tends to be white readers. It's very refreshing and it feels like a safe space. So one of my favorite phrases from the whole book is when you say, "Conversations around brainwashing in the early Cold War were often characterized by inflated claims and sanctimonious assumptions about Western civilized values and moral ascendancy." Now, as far as I'm concerned, that's basically the entire discourse around Western civilization. But I think it's important to point out that the reason we know in detail about these techniques, who was doing what and where, is that the fact that they were happening on both sides of what starts out as an East-West dichotomy. But in point of fact, that binary is no use to us at all, really. Everyone is at the same thing.
Yes, and I think that's right. And I think that where this story does get complicated, not just in our reading of it now or the reading you've just offered of this, but it already in the 50s was the realization that this story that begins as a story about the East, that is initiated in the West with this language of brainwashing, which is itself meant to be a translation from Chinese. So it's gone from Chinese to sort of American discourse, supposedly as a sort of straight translation of something that then the West needs to be worried about. And that begins as a discourse about totalitarianism, for which read communism at this point, then also starts to boomerang back on the West. So that the question then about how free are we in the West is always sort of in a way anxiously there. And even Hunter, as he's looking at the way in which psychiatry can be abused with mental hospital patients, with prisoners and so on, starts to sort of at least raise some questions. And by the late 1950s, there's a whole separate literature on advertising, which catches a kind of wave of public interest and concern with books like The Hidden Persuaders, that sort of suggests that this whole sort of idea of the free consumer and voter is itself something of a mirage, and actually the ways in which we may be manipulated to buy or to vote need to be studied and taken very seriously. So it starts to be a more complicated question, I think, that cuts across the idea of sort of our liberal freedom and their totalitarian subjection, and becomes in a way a more interesting discourse. And you see this, I think, in the movies as well, where it can both in a way echo these very sort of clear-cut supposed moral distinctions and then also undercut them. There's a lot of worry in this period about what happens in the mental asylum, and that itself becomes almost a microcosm for thinking about the idealization of Western freedom in stories like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest in the 1960s that becomes then a famous film later on.
Well, actually, it's funny you should mention that, because you talk about Irving Goffman and the idea of the total institution. So this is an institution that limits the freedom of some people in society, despite or possibly in direct contrast to the freedom of others. I immediately thought about the Mental Deficiency Act of 1913 in the UK. I think a lot of British people comfort themselves, probably a little bit falsely, with the notion that eugenics was not something that happened here. It was never written into legislation here. But the Mental Deficiency Act altogether meant that disabled people were locked up to much the same effect as enforced sterilization programs that kind of happened everywhere in the world. So there is an aspect of, you know, we need to face what happens in our own society. What the easy thing to do is to demonize what happens elsewhere. And I do want to come on to this idea about marketing, because it's the bit that is very undermining to me as an individual, and I think a lot of other people will sympathize with that. But before we do that, I also do want to talk about one of my favorite of the many, many characters that we are introduced to in your book, George Jackson, who is a member of the Black Panther Party. And the point that he makes in and amongst all this idea of prison industrial complex and the nature of society in the United States was that all Americans were brainwashed into thinking that they lived in a free and equal society. I'm paraphrasing and polemicizing slightly his position. Well, maybe not that much polemicizing, but I think this is how this idea sort of breaks the bounds of it is done by science and by the state. This is looking completely at the fundamentals of Western society and how we run it.
And some of the same commentators who are writing about Chinese brainwashing also then become advisors to the prison industrial system in the US. So there's an idea that these techniques that are being studied for dealing with prisoners could also be applied as a way of managing the burgeoning prison population. So there's also a kind of interesting crossover. And there's a very remarkable book on the history of solitary confinement in the US penitentiary system by the Canadian philosopher Lisa Gunter that I would also recommend to people, that explores this question very powerfully. And I think that with George Jackson, who spends his adult life in prison in the 1960s and writes these remarkable letters where he does invoke this idea of brainwashing and false consciousness and so on, you can see how this language starts to take on other purposes. You know, the question of who's brainwashing whom and so on starts to become much more complex. And I think that as I was trying to get my head around this history, really, it was on the one hand to be suspicious of the melodramatic use of the term brainwashing. I mean, to sort of feel it's a term that we need to treat with caution, not just assume as some given, you know, that there is this thing called brainwashing. And on the other hand, not to somehow too easily just assume, well, this is just sort of froth and hot air and mythology. I mean, there are practices that are described in that literature that are deeply sinister and that would affect anybody's psychology. I mean, to be a captive in a supermax prison, whether it's in the US or in some dungeon in a foreign country, is going to affect you in the way described in the
50s. It's not that these things are just fantasies that are sort of constructed by overblown writers in the 50s. So we're having to sort of think about what is inflated and, as it were, ideologically driven in the very language of brainwashing. And on the other hand, to sort of think, well, what is it that we need to salvage from that that is of real material concern to us? The person who I think does that very importantly early on is the American psychiatrist Robert J. Lifton, who's again one of the characters in my story who writes on thought reform in that early period, and neither wants to go along with the sort of sensationalized version of it, nor to just dismiss it as somehow overblown rhetoric. So he's an important figure. And then I think the other thing that is one has to work out one's position is not to equate all societies and just say, well, all societies are the same. People are brainwashed everywhere. It's all much of a muchness, which I think would not be right. But nor to have the sort of complacent assumption that somehow so-called liberal democracies are simply bastions of liberal democracy. I mean, these are ideals, but the practice is something else. I mean, for instance, the widespread use of torture, which I think, again, is one of the features of this story, was we were talking about fascism and communism and capitalism. But of course, there's also empire and the end of empire and decolonization and that whole history through that period with the French in Algeria or the British in Kenya that is also then exposed. I mean, the techniques that are used with prisoners of both physical torture and mental torture complicates the story of, as you were suggesting, of Western so-called civilization.
Thank you very much for endorsing my thesis on this. I feel vindicated and I appreciate it. I want to pull on this thread just a teeny bit more because I'm sensing you are a historian, you are an academic, your work is clearly highly researched and well-grounded in the archive. But brainwashing as an idea, I think, is the hint that I'm getting from you here, is that it's a metaphor that has slipped into the ways in which we talk about our society, probably in ways that aren't necessarily accurate or helpful. And I'm wondering, is there a particular instance or are there instances when you've heard the expression used or the term used as a metaphor where you think, oh, that really is not a good way to be thinking about this situation?
Well, I was very impressed by a group of teenagers. One of the things we did in our collective project, which was funded, I should say, by the Wellcome Trust. So it was a grant that enabled a whole group of researchers and filmmakers to work on this for a few years. But we went into some schools in London and gave teenagers a chance to make short video essays, which we've put on the website. People can watch them. And in one discussion, actually not with one of those groups who made the films, but in another school where they were looking at this material, the school kids at a certain point invited to reflect on brainwashing, say, well, our school's brainwashing us, isn't it? It's just the same. School is brainwashing, you know, exams are brainwashing. And then other members of the group said, no, hang on a minute. And then their rather nice young teacher who'd facilitated this discussion said, so you're saying I'm a brainwasher?
Aww.
And then they felt very bad for him because they didn't think of him. They said, no, not you. Anyway, started to generate a conversation amongst themselves about what kind of terms would actually more accurately describe the kinds of opportunity, but also psychic impoverishment of going to school and doing A-levels. So there was something they were getting at about their lives, but that brainwashing didn't seem the right term. And in the course of that conversation, they sort of nuanced it and said, no, our school's not brainwashing us. That's not the right term. It's everyone's struggling a bit. The school are doing their best. They ended up with a sort of, as it were, complicating their own, the starting point of some of them, which was school brainwashes you, doesn't it? So I think often in any conversation, as one starts to tease out what's going on, how far are we facilitated to learn, to think, to develop, whether it's also mental health professionals who are in the business of helping people to be freer and saner, how far can these professions, whether it's the educational professions or the mental health professions, be corralled into quite other projects that are to do with conformity, discipline, even so-called brainwashing, are questions that merit our continuing scrutiny. And Hannah Arendt, who was one of the great philosophers really to think about totalitarianism, doesn't want to equate the US with Nazi Germany or Stalinist Russia. But she says we need to be ever vigilant in whichever society it is to look at the sort of creeping moments of the, as it were, the pull into totalitarian processes, practices, mechanisms, because it's always in a way an option. We cannot ever, as it were, rest on the laurels of assuming, whether it's at the level of a school, a psychoanalytic institution, a psychiatric hospital, a university, whatever, that somehow it's all bound to be fine and freedom flourishes. There's always a question, I think, of needing to sort of explore the mechanisms that are enhance or detract from that.
Entirely. So there's a quote in your book where you say that she says that truly independent thinking is not possible without the capacity to change one's mind, which is the story that you've just told us, which is so compelling about those students. That's really not a part of how our current discourse is working. And my personal bugbear with brainwashed is, you know, I've had that expression leveled at me, not so much because people believe it or they can expound a theory of how it has happened, but very much as sort of a way of shutting down an argument by suggesting that I'm not capable of thinking for myself. So I think, well, if I have a question there, is, are there any tips for kind of getting around that? How do you confront someone who's so unwilling to listen to what you are saying on the grounds that you're not able to think for yourself? Is it possible to have a conversation there?
Well, one hopes that conversation's possible. Of course, sometimes it isn't. One reaches the limit of what is possible, in whether it's in a dialogue or something else. But I think that the question of the freedom, you were quoting Arendt from my book, of the freedom to change one's mind in a society, the freedom also to go on sort of struggling to differentiate truth and lies. It doesn't mean anyone can claim absolute truth, but one of her points about totalitarianism is not in the Orwellian sense that everybody comes to be a zealous believer, but that a society can operate in such a way that telling the difference becomes impossible. So a sort of total obfuscation and confusion that can be generated so that there's no basis on which to tell. And that's one of her arguments, of this sort of sense of just being dazed, of confronted with the world, that nothing makes sense and you give up on trying to differentiate. And actually, again, another character in my story, I mean, who was a defector from Poland in 1951, Miłosz, who later wins the Nobel Prize for Literature for his poetry. But he writes a book in 1953 called The Captive Mind, which impressed me a lot. It's less well known than Animal Farm and 1984, but I think it's really an interesting book in which he tries to sort of describe what it was like to live in Stalinist Poland for a Western readership after he's defected. He's not sure people in the West will understand what it was like, but he tries to convey it. And it's not the Orwellian picture that everyone is converted and brainwashed in that sense, but he more describes a world in which the consequence of getting it wrong, of changing your mind the wrong way, can be fatal, and in which expressing what you think becomes extremely dangerous, so that people sort of gradually develop practices of concealment and of accommodation and negotiation of many different kinds, but where, the private and the public are ever more disconnected, or at least that's the endeavor, to keep your private thoughts private and to express what requires to be expressed in order to survive. And he describes a world in which you have to then assume other people are doing that. So there's a kind of world of communication in which you have to make inferences about what other people may really be thinking, regardless of what they're saying. There's the performance of, as it were, allegiance to the regime, but that doesn't necessarily mean someone believes. And that becomes the sort of acrobatics of communication in a world where it can be lethal to get it wrong.
And your affection for Miłosz comes across in the book, particularly in terms of the huge amount of nuance that he brings to his own experience, but then trying to see, you know, how does this translate into a new place? I am now speaking as someone who is perfectly capable of being hypnotized by their own Instagram feed so that I lose track of time. There's aspects of marketing, there are aspects of what used to be called subliminal messaging inherent in the way that we absorb and consume media today that sometimes doesn't even feel like we're actively thinking about anything. So you talk a fair bit about groupthink in the book. There's a whole chapter dedicated to groupthink. And the thing that really undermined me individually was this idea that, you know, I consider myself to be generally liberal, generally left-leaning, and generally kind of nonconformist. But that's nonetheless, the point that you make there is that nonetheless is still a persona to be marketed to. I might be disparaging of my contemporaries and their brunches and bifold doors, but that's still an aspect that can somehow be sold to in our modern world.
Yes, and Think Different became an advertising slogan and approach to the idea of being an individual. There could be forms of marketing that were designed to reassure you, to reassure the public that they were like the neighbour, that you were keeping up with the Joneses in that proverbial expression, that you were the same. And that could be one strategy. Another was you're different, you're better, you're an individual. And that could itself be marketed. So as you say, there's a sort of irony to the idea I'm expressing myself when one may be just being manipulated by a different sort of form of campaigning that takes hold. But I think you also mentioned their hypnosis, you know, which takes us into a different history. I mean, we were talking earlier about eugenics and, you know, racial engineering and sort of late Victorian stuff. But there's also this earlier history of ideas about mesmerism, named after Franz Anton Mesmer, late 18th century Vienna, but the idea of cure through animal magnetism. And he becomes this charismatic figure and people go to Mesmer for help with all sorts of symptoms. And later we have, you mentioned hypnosis, which is another term that comes in the sort of state of lucid sleep. And that becomes a subject of growing inquiry in the Victorian period, of our propensity to fall into sort of hypnotic states. There's something fundamental about the human condition that we can not just be awake and sleep, but be sort of half awake or in a sort of trance-like state or pulled back to something very dreamy, going on autopilot, tuning out. And that's, in a way, again, back shadows this story about enchantment in the 1950s through advertising and through politics, all the concern about brainwashing and groupthink, but how questionable it is that we are fully, as it were, discerning, on the ball consumers or voters or subjects, but that we may be in some much more dreamlike state and that this can itself be easily manipulated.
We've talked about sort of the washing aspect of brainwashing, but to me, I think the interesting bit here is the brain, because if we think about the history of science, the brain is only very recently come to rest as the place, you know, where we acknowledge or we seem to think that this is the place where we do our thinking and knowing. It's a very modern idea. But in fact, a lot of the way that culture influences and catches us is elsewhere. You know, it catches us in our nervous system or in our gut or seemingly our innate need to belong. So I wonder whether there's more to the washing than simply just the brain.
Yes. Well, we were talking earlier about the way in which the body can also be devastated by a regime, by a custodial regime, and that the body can be broken. One thing to say about those early debates about brainwashing and what and your interest, you were saying, in ideas about civilization and, quote, race. One of the questions was, is everybody equally brainwashable? And there were commentators in the 50s who did think that some people were more prone to this state of brainwashing, whether it was African-Americans, whether it was people from the East, whether it was gay people. There were all sorts of ideas about the sort of relative malleability of the mind. And then there was a sort of critique of that, the realization everyone is equally vulnerable to this. But it was a racialized discourse. I mean, the group of 21 American GIs who caused a storm in 1953 are also an interesting part of this story. This is at the end of the Korean War. Many thousands of prisoners are held on both sides. And at the end, the UN oversees a prisoner swap operation where the prisoners of war are allowed to choose their destination rather than to be automatically repatriated. And the Americans particularly were keen to allow prisoners to have a choice because they didn't want, as it were, North Korean and Chinese POWs would be forced back into the communist state. And many of those prisoners did choose to go elsewhere, actually. But the big story became this smaller group of American GIs who chose to go and live in China. And there were three African-American soldiers who were part of that group. And I write about one of them, Clarence Adams, and he describes the racism he suffers growing up and his own reasons for choosing China. And his, again, going back to his individual story of why he goes. And when he does eventually change his mind and returns to the US, he's subjected to a very, very hostile reception. But anyway, those questions of race, both in the treatment of people, but also in the sort of theorization of the mind in that period, is striking. One of the things also to say about gender in this is that it is a story mostly about men, not only about men, but these are male soldiers. There are women in the 50s who become, as it were, newsworthy stories. There was a Fulbright scholar, I think it was Harriet Mills, I hope I've got the name right, but who was held by the Chinese whilst she was there. And later she says she was brainwashed and she starts to sort of express sympathies for the communists. And so that there were women held captive in the People's Republic. But the primary story is about men. And these are men who were meant to be sort of indomitable and tough, who'd been trained by the army. And that leads to a lot of sort of panic about, is the training wrong? How do you prepare soldiers to resist captivity and interrogation? And, you know, and that then gets sort of manualized in the 50s and 60s of new forms of training to cope with interrogation as a kind of aftermath of that.
I wonder whether you could give our listeners a quick and dirty survival guide to how to survive in a society that is potentially brainwashing.
We don't have to be in a totalitarian society to worry about the way we can get, as it were, caught up in a kind of micro tyranny, whether it's in a particular community, a family, an institution. But access to alternative points of view, to debate, to critique, is vital in every sense, of course. And that we do have resources. I mean, some of us are more fortunate than others in our upbringing, in whether we have a family and friends and a community or carers or teachers who are helpful in encouraging, as it were, the potential to explore and experiment and to be allowed to get things wrong and to develop, as opposed to having to conform. To varying degrees, of course, we all have to conform in order to survive in a society that, as it were, the narcissism we have of, as children, as infants and as grown-ups, of wanting everything to go our way has to be constrained. So there is a sort of coming up against the limits of, as it were, our freedom to do as we like in relation to the other. That's different, I think, to the kind of discussion we're having about forms of zealotry and enforced belief that can happen in a total institution, a totalitarian society, and so on. But I think it's to be vigilant and to seek out resources where we're allowed to, as it were, think, and to be, in a way, questioning, in the way you were saying of yourself, whether it's consumption, politics, but of our own certainties. Of course, doubt can also be used in a way to manipulate people. It's not only certainty. It's not only conviction. There can be ways, as we know with Cambridge Analytica and these manipulations online, of sowing so much doubt that people don't bother to vote at all. The idea of it's all hopeless, of a kind of state of total apathy, where the doubt is, as it were, weaponized. So it's not only conviction. And I suppose what I'm trying to suggest in the book is that there are resources in the literature of that earlier period and the cinema of that period and the storytelling of that period that can help us to think about this problem of thinking. I also think psychoanalysis, at its best, there can be, this, as it were, a safe space in which you can try to find out about your own mind without a coercive pressure. Of course, any form of mental health practice or theory can also become something else than that. But at its best, I think it is about that. I mean, for Freud, it was about abandonment of hypnosis, and his encouragement of free association was to be interested in what, as it were, emerged when there is no obvious constraint, when you're invited to say whatever comes to your mind without selection, as opposed to a sort of guiding, charismatic authority who will tell you what to think or coax you in how to think. But that can be, I think, an important space as well, both theoretically and in practice, for exploring this.
Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. Your book is an education I would encourage, but certainly not force anyone else to read it. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
That was Daniel Pick, author of Brainwashed, A New History of Thought Control, available now from Profile Books in conjunction with the Wellcome Collection and wherever you buy books.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Intelligence Squared. This episode was produced by senior producer Tom Hall, with editing from executive producer Rowan Slaney. We'd love to hear your feedback and what you think we should talk about next, who we should have on, and what our future debates should be. Send us an email or a voice note with your thoughts to podcasts@intelligencesquared.com or tweet us @intelligence2. And if you'd like to hear more, attend some of our excellent events, or peruse over 20 years of our back catalogue, ad-free, featuring some of the world's greatest minds, and head over to intelligencesquared.com.